All right, our text this morning is Deuteronomy. I hate to call it Deuteronomy, second law. Fifth Moses, chapter 11. Those of you who come from Scandinavian or German traditions, you know that's what we call this book. The Torah of Moses is Fifth Moses. Our text is chapter 15, verses 1 to 11. I have never heard a sermon on this text in my life. And it is actually, I think, a great loss that we have not preached this text, because I hope by the time we're done, we will all recognize not only its liberating message, but its appeal for a faith that is rooted in the heart and lived out, and that presents to the world the contrast to the values by which they live. It's texts like this that lead foreigners to say, as we have it in chapter 4, verses 5 to 8. Look, I've taught you statutes and judgments just as the Lord my God commanded you, that you should do thus in the land where you're entering to possess it. So keep them and do them, for that is your, in our tradition, we would say, that is your obligation and your burden. And we feel so sorry for the Israelites because they're saddled with the law. No. For that is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who will hear all these statutes and say, wow, this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God whenever we call on Him? Only Israel has a God who answers prayer. Or what great nation is there that has statutes and judgments? All nations have statutes and judgments. But what is distinctive here is that these are unparalleled in their righteousness. Judgments as righteous as this whole Torah that I am setting before you today. So that if the Israelites would live by this Torah, the nations would look on with envy. Wow, I wish we had that. And when you see this passage, I hope we grasp what's going on here. Now, our passage, did you see the super full moon a little while ago? Deuteronomy has nothing to say about the festival of new moons and full moons, but the wife of a former student of mine posted this one. It's a spectacular picture of the super full moon. I hope you rejoiced and praised God when you saw that full moon just a couple of weeks ago. But anyhow, we're back to our text. Let's introduce the passage. I hope you ran off the outlines. If you're not on the mailing list and you're not getting the outlines, I would encourage you to see Don Maltz, who's not here, but I gave you earlier his email address. Send him an email. And then perhaps in preparation for the class, you can have that outline before you as you read the passage. But first, we need to make a few comments first about the structure of the passage. This passage divides into two parts, two uneven parts, actually. You have Moses' announcement of the policy regarding the poor. The theme, of course, is soft hands and open hearts. This is part two. At the end of chapter 14, we had part one, soft hands and open hearts toward God, so that the giving of the tithes is an expression of holding on to that which we have loosely. Well, here, that one was vertical. This one is horizontal. This is part two, soft hands and open hearts, generosity toward the poor in the family. Now, in this one, the two parts, first verses 1 to 3, you have Moses' announcement of the policy regarding the poor. This part actually sounds a little bit like law. Listen. At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a remission of debts. This is the way of remission. Every creditor shall release what he has loaned to his neighbor. He shall not exact it of his neighbor and his brother, because the Lord's remission has been proclaimed. For a foreigner, you may exact it, but your hand shall release whatever is yours is with your brother. There is the ordinance, if you want to call it that. Three verses of ordinance. But the interesting thing is in this text, and this is typical of Deuteronomy, 11 verses, only three of which are devoted to the actual declaration of, if you want to call it, the law of the remission. The rest of this passage is sermon, the appeal for this remission. And so you have his plea to his congregation. But however, there will be no poor among you, since the Lord will surely bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you as a grant to possess. If only you listen obediently to the voice of the Lord your God to observe carefully all this whole command which I am commanding you today. For the Lord your God will bless you as he has promised you, and you will lend to many nations, but you will not borrow. You will rule over many nations, but they will not rule over you. If there is a poor man with you, one of your brothers, in any of your towns, in your land, which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor close your hand from your poor brother. But you shall surely freely open your hand to him and shall generously lend to him sufficient for his need in whatever he lacks. Watch out that there is no base thought. We'll talk about all these expressions in a moment. Watch out that there is no base thought in your heart saying the seventh year, the year of remission, it's near and your eye is hostile toward your poor brother and you give him nothing. Then he may cry to the Lord against you and it will be a sin in you. You shall generously give to him and your heart shall not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in all your undertakings. For the poor will never cease to be in the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall freely open your hand to your brother as to your needy poor in your land. Doesn't sound at all like law. Now, it is Moses' pastoral appeal. Not just to keep the law of verses 1 to 3, because you have to. It's a law. But no, he is trying to shape the disposition of the heart so that the law given in verses 1 to 3 becomes actually a natural outflowing of what's in here. That is the shape of this text. So in your notes I have, in terms of tone, 80% of this is devoted to the sermon. 158 out of 194 words. That's in the Hebrew. Your translations, the numbers are going to be different. But this is the book of Deuteronomy. This is the way the proportions go throughout this book. You could, I have a feeling that if you would count all the words in Deuteronomy and isolate those that are actual laws, you would come up with a proportion something like this. In fact, it may even be less than 20% is actual law. So, in any case, that's the structure and the tone. The appeal to adopt the policy regarding the poor, verses 4 to 11, divides further, as we will see, into Israel's future economic ideal and Israel's future economic reality. You may have noticed as I was reading, there will never be any poor among you. In one verse, and a couple of verses down the road, there will always be poor among you. Moses, what are you talking about? Isn't that a fundamental contradiction? How can you both have the poor, inevitably, and have no poor, inevitably? Well, we'll have to talk about that. But let's go, first of all, then, to the actual law as we try and understand this passage. The policy regarding the poor, verses 1 to 3. We have to start here by talking about the word for this law of remission. It's called the law of Shemitah, which is actually a rare word in the Bible. It is used elsewhere only in a few places. And the expression we have here is, you shall do or practice or make Shemitah. It occurs in verse 1, 2, and 9. Elsewhere, only in chapter 31, verse 10, in the book of Deuteronomy, at the end of every 7 years, at the set time in the year of Shemitah, at the Feast of Booths. We've talked about this passage here and there. Moses, after he's done with his addresses, he writes them down and he hands them to the elders and to the Levitical priests. And then he tells them at the end of every 7 years at the Feast of Booths, you are to read this entire Torah that I have delivered to you. Well, this is part of it. At the end of every 7 years at the set time in the year of release, which raises the second question. What does he mean by at the end of 7 years? In our text too, at the end of every 7 years, you shall do Shemitah. 7 years. Now, there are several different ways in which we could interpret that. Before we get there, there's one other text we should read. And this is from from Exodus chapter 23, verse 10 to 11. We have this one. For 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but the seventh year you shall let it rest. Shamat. That's the Hebrew verb from the same root as Shemitah, which is the noun. And let it lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave, the wild animals may eat. You shall do the same with your vineyards and your olive groves. This is the basic policy of the sabbatical year. In the sabbatical year, you don't work your fields. You let the fields relax. Let them rest. And of course, this all has to do, remember, with the triangle. We'll bring it back again later. The triangle, God is up here, Israel and the land are in covenant relationship. How you treat the land, which actually is God's land, is a reflection of your disposition toward Him. And if you treat the land right, then it will treat you right. Well, this is the sabbatical year policy. But let's talk then about the seventh year, the technical term for the policy, but the timing. In the seventh year, what does this mean? There are several possibilities. First, it could mean sometime in the last year of the seven-year cycle. Not necessarily at the end or at the beginning, but in the seventh year generally, you are to release all of the indebtedness of people who owe you stuff. Could mean that. It could mean at the beginning of the seventh year. In the seventh year, that is, at the beginning of the seventh year. Or it could be at the end of the seventh year before we begin the new seven-year cycle. Or it could be at a festival in the seventh year. I'm not sure what this means. We don't have any record in the biblical texts about the Israelites actually doing this. And you may remember, we already hear in Leviticus 26, if you persist in your rebellion against God, the ultimate punishment will be defeat at the hands of the enemies and the exile of the people from the land. To compensate for the sabbatical years that you didn't keep. And actually, when you read the end of Chronicles, there it actually tells us they went into exile for 70 years because that's how many sabbatical years they missed. Oh, now do the math. If they missed 70 sabbatical years, how many total years have they been in rebellion? 490. The exile happens in 586. Now back up 490 years. What does that get us? 970? 1070? It's the beginning. What happened about the year 10,000? We get a king. About, 1,000 BC. 10,000? No, that's, we don't know. 1,000. We get a king. And what happens very quickly with the kings? Already with the second king, we get court-sponsored apostasy. Solomon builds temples for the gods of his wives. And of course, in the book of Judges, you thought kings were the solution to the problem. We discover, actually, they weren't. They greased the slide of the problem. And so, all of that to say that how the Israelites kept the sabbatical year or didn't was a barometer of their spiritual condition. And in the end, if they go into exile for 70 years, it's because that's how many sabbatical years they missed. But there's one other thing here we need to talk about. Does this mean that everybody would keep the sabbatical year at the same time? I'm not sure. That could create serious economic problems. I have a hunch that the clock starts ticking the day a household is established. And so this becomes an individual household matter rather than a national matter, so that every seventh year the whole nation is on vacation. I have a feeling the clock starts running when you get married. Well, actually, if you got married and your father was still living, you would probably settle in an apartment right next to his, and that would be the household. My sense is that every time a new household is established, that's when the clock starts ticking, and you do the math after that. But the text doesn't actually tell us that. If it is in the seventh year at the festival of Sukkoth, it would be the 15th day of the seventh month, Tishri, in the autumn when they would be doing this. All right, let's look at the actual terms of the policy. In your notes, you will see that I have summarized the terms as four. First, in general terms, Moses calls on all creditors to release their claims on the debtors. At the end of 7 years, you shall grant a remission of debts. So this is the general policy. All creditors are to release their claims on their neighbors. And of course, we'll talk more about that. So that's point number one. You release the claims on your neighbors. Second, this is the manner of every creditor shall release what he has loaned to his neighbor. He shall not exact it of his neighbor. Actually, the word here is he shall not pressure his neighbor. Don't put the squeeze on him. Come on. Give, deliver. Third, Israelites may continue to pressure foreigners. From the foreigner you may pressure, but your hand shall release whatever of yours is with your brother. that is a fellow Israelite. Now, of course, to us that may seem unfair. It does remind us that taking a pledge for loans that you give to people is not in itself immoral. In fact, they even allow Israelites to take a pledge, a guarantee security that you will pay the debt back later on. He'll talk about what kind of pledges people can give, especially they'll give you their cloak as a guarantee that they'll get you your money back. Actually, they didn't have money in those days. They didn't have coins, but whatever is loaned to your neighbor. But here, notice, you may demand it from your neighbor, but you may not demand it from your brother. From whatever you have loaned to your brother, the fourth principle, Israelite creditors are to release their claims on their neighbors. Of course, this reminds us that the covenant community is one big family. Israel was called out of Egypt to be a city on a hill, God's trophy of grace, a miniature of humanity, the way God intended us when He planted us in the garden. And Canaan is a miniature Garden of Eden. And the way the Israelites relate to each other is to be a witness to the whole world of what healthy relationships horizontally and vertically look like. Which means that outsiders will wish they were insiders. And of course, this is not unique to ancient Israel. Paul says in Galatians, therefore let us do good to all. And what does he add? Especially to those who are of the household of faith. We are brothers and sisters, members of one family. Yahweh the Lord is our Father. Sons you are to the Lord your God, chapter 14, verse 1. And so, these are family relationships that are being maintained, even the way in which we treat debts. Now, that makes sense. Even when we're growing up within the family, you loan stuff to your brothers or your sisters, and you loan from them, and we do it rather freely and, you know, kind of casually. We don't need legal written documentation for everything we do. But this is how the family relates. And what Moses is trying to do, I've said it many times before, Moses is trying to create an ethos within which the life of godliness is lived and demonstrated. And that's what we've got here. In this way, we have a community where nobody is actually second class. You may feel economically second class for a few years. But every 7 years, the playing field is leveled again and we start over. And of course, when Moses starts preaching about this, you'll see how he wants it actually to work. Let's go then to, we have here the four policies, terms. I forget to put, I'm assuming you have these. Creditors are not to pressure their debtors, their brothers, and the grounds is it is a divine ordinance. We should have talked about this. In verse 2, he shall not exact it of his neighbor and his brother because the Lord's remission has been proclaimed. Compare this with Hammurabi's law code. In Hammurabi, it's interesting that the law codes from the ancient Near East, this apparently loaning and taking out loans was a common practice. But in Hammurabi's policy, if an obligation is outstanding against a man and he sells or gives into debt service his wife, his son, or his daughter, they shall perform service in the house of their buyer or of the one who holds them in debt service for 3 years, and their release shall be secured in the fourth year. You know, so you've got equivalent policies in other parts of the world as well. Creditors are not to pressure debtors. Creditors may pressure foreigners. They are not. They are to release their claim to the debts others own them in the seventh year. Of course, this could create tensions and bitterness, as Moses will anticipate in the moment. So let's go to Moses' sermon. In Moses' sermon, he talks about two things. First of all, he describes Israel's future economic ideal. Oh, this is nirvana, utopia, he's talking about in verses 4 to 6. There will be no poor among you, since the Lord your God will surely bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you as a grant to possess. If only you listen obediently to the voice of the Lord your God to observe carefully this whole command that I am commanding you, for the Lord your God will bless you as he promised you, and you will lend to many nations, but you will not borrow. You will rule over many nations, but they will not rule over you. That is an ideal world. There'll be no poor. Everybody will be coming to you for your aid. You will not need to go to anybody else for aid. Now, this divides into two parts. The first part has to do with personal economics. In the personal economics, you have the utopian ideal. There will be no poor among you. This is dreaming. In a world that is the way God wants it to be, that's what will be the case. This is Eden, where all the needs are met. No one is poor. Economically, we are all equals. We all have all that we need. This is the personal ideal. But look at the preconditions. This is interesting. Two preconditions here. Notice, there will be no poor among you because Yahweh will surely bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you as his grant to possess. That's the guarantee. The blessing of God. Now, on first sight, it looks like this blessing is unconditional. But read on. Why will, or under what circumstances will God bless you? Ah, here it is. If only you listen obediently to the voice, or listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God, and observe carefully this whole command. It's interesting, he uses the singular. My translation actually has commandment. We've talked about that before. Why do we even use the word commandment in translations? You never use that word in everyday life. It creates the impression that this is otherworldly. No. Just call it this whole command, which means the whole picture of life under God. And life lived before one another. If you live according to this whole big picture, then God will bless you. And of course, we've seen that before in chapter 7 and in chapter 11. The right to blessing is not an automatic entitlement. This is a world in which God blesses Israel as Israel lives scrupulously according to the will of God. We've had this triangle up here before. This is the world in which covenant relationship is functioning perfectly. When God blesses, Israel prospers, and Canaan, the land yields its produce. When Israel obeys, Canaan yields its produce. There's enough for everybody, and God sends the rain. When the land produces, God rejoices, and the people celebrate. These are the three parties to this covenant relationship, and in the ideal world, this whole relationship is functioning smoothly. Within that context, God is happy with Israel. Israel is happy with God. The land is happy with God. And the land is happy with Israel. They are all working together smoothly. This machine is nicely oiled. Let's go to the corporate economics. That is at the personal level. All of these are first-person singular verbs. There will be no poor among you, but if only you will listen to the voice, the Lord will bless you. Now in verse 6, we come to the corporate. For the Lord will bless you as He has promised you, and you will lend to many nations. That does not mean individual bankers. It means you, as a people, will lend to many nations, but you will not borrow. You will rule over many nations, but they will not rule over you. Actually, in Hebrew, it's a very deliberate way. And loan you shall to many nations, but you shall not loan to any. And then, and rule you shall over many nations, but over you none will rule. Actually, if we go to the covenant blessings as they are summarized in chapter 28, verses 1 to 14, you have this again in verse 12. If you live according to the covenant and rejoice in the grace of God, Yahweh will open to you His good treasure, the heavens, to give the rain to your land in its season and to bless all the work of your hands. Notice the triangle is working. God, the land, and the people. And you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. But on the other hand, if you persist in your rebellion later, He will say, the nations will come after you, not for your money, but with their armies to attack you and to destroy you. So this is an image of Israel being an agent of generosity and grace to the whole world. It's a city on a hill. Chapter 26, verse 19. See, I've set you high above the nations for praise, for honor, and for glory. Whose praise, honor, and glory? Not Israel's, but the praise, honor, and glory of God who has done all this for Israel. There's the ideal. But Moses comes down to earth very quickly. If only. And so in verses 7 to 11, he deals with the economic reality. This is what we wish would happen. But then he adds, we should talk first of all a little bit about Moses' rhetorical strategy. In this, he is very deliberate in the way in which he develops the point now with keen pastoral insight and wisdom. He gives us his description of the ideal, and then he invites people to live by this ideal. If not, this is what will happen. Notice Moses' arguments here. First of all, he gives instructions on how to treat the poor. He begins with where the people are. He appeals to Israel's sense of family. We'll see all this. If there's a poor man with you, one of your brothers in any of your towns, then he addresses Israel's fundamental sinfulness, but You shall not harden your heart nor close your hand from your brother, but you shall freely open to him so that he has what he needs. He addresses the interior and exterior dimensions of ethics, your hands and your heart. And then he employs direct speech. Verse 9, beware that there is no base thought in your heart that you say. You know, the seventh year, the year of remission, is very close. I know that when that seventh year comes, I'm going to have to let it all go. So what will I do? I'll pressure the debtor so that he gets to me everything before the seventh year comes. I mean, Moses is has keen psychological insight here. But these are instructions on how to treat the poor. So let's back up a little bit. How shall we treat the poor? Verses 7 and 8. The context, when the needy person is among you. Notice again, Moses likes to do everything in threes. We've said this before. A good sermon has 3 points. Here you have it. If there is a poor man among you, and then notice what he says. One of your brothers, in any of your towns, literally it's gates, remember? A town, your translation probably has city. A city has nothing to do with size. A city is a community with walls and gates. And so gates becomes a figure of speech for in any of your communities. And then he extends it to the land. If there is any poor among your brothers, in your towns, in your land. So it's at the family, at the community, and at the national level. So that if somebody from Naphtali comes to an Ephraimite and says, look, I got a problem. Can you help me? Don't say, oh, you're a Naphtalite. I have nothing to do with it. No, we're all one family. And so it's a comprehensive picture. If there is a needy, not just your immediate family, your brother, that's the domestic unit, not just your community, but the whole land. When a needy person is among you, how shall we handle them? Negatively. Do not harden your heart or shut your hand. It's amazing, Moses' perception here. And actually, in his warning, he mentions 3 potential pathologies. Don't harden your heart or shut your hand, but positively open your hand and lend to your brother whatever he needs. 3 pathologies. It's interesting the expressions he uses here. First of all, we have twisted minds. Beware that there is no base thought in your heart. That's what my translation has. But how can you have a thought in the heart? The heart doesn't think. The mind thinks. And of course, now I remind you that in Hebrew, they don't have separate words for heart and mind. It's all the same. In 50% of the cases in the Old Testament where you have this word lev for heart, it is the thinker. It's what comes out of your mind. And this is why when Jesus translates the Shema, Shema Yisrael, Yahweh Eloheinu, Yahweh Echad, Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is our God, the Lord alone. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. Those of you who have been with us, not soul, your being and your resources, all your stuff. These are 3 concentric circles. Your interior, both heart and mind. Your whole body devoted to God, and then all of your stuff is also devoted to God. This is Romans 12:1. I beseech you, brothers, therefore, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. We tend to think that in the Old Testament, people sacrificed their animals and their crops. In the New Testament, they give themselves. I've got news for you. A false dichotomy. Everything devoted to God. Well, when Jesus translates that in the Gospels, he says, you shall love the Lord your, the greatest command, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. How many words does he use? He uses four. He translates three Hebrew words with four English, four Greek words. Jesus is a NLT person. He knows that if you render lave with heart, you'll miss 50% of the connotation. If you render it only with mind, you'll miss the other 50%. So what do? True translation communicates the whole thing. And so he gives it. Well, here. Beware that no base thought arises in your mind, and you say, the seventh year of the remission is near. A twisted mind. That's a problem. A twisted mind says that I need to get as much out of my brother as I can while I still have the chance. That's twisted thinking. The word for Belial here is the same word that's used of rascals, sons of Belial. These are twisted people. This is twisted thinking. Second, you have an evil eye. Beware that you no base thought arises in your heart, and your eye is, my translation has, hostile to your brother. No, it's not just hostile. The word here is evil. It's the opposite of good. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. This is evil. And what is the evil here? The evil is, the evil in your eye is that you look with meanness on your brother. And then the third pathology, a misshapen hand. Your eye is hostile to your brother, and you give him nothing. Then he may cry to the Lord his God, and it will be to you. You shall generously give him. Your heart shall not be grieved. You shall give to him. But the tight-fisted hand in the community of faith, hands are open. And if there is someone with a need, someone with the resources, naturally, spontaneously gives a misshapen hand. What are the effects of this? You know, notice that it's a physical pathology. Your eyes are wrong. You need a lobotomy, a mind transplant, and your hands are misshapen. What are the effects of this? First, you give him not. Then he may cry to the Lord against you. Well, what's the problem here? You have one Israelite appealing to the Lord to deal punitively with another Israelite. And if you got the poor appealing to the Lord to deal punitively with a rich, guess on whose side the Lord is. And secondly, the effect. Yahweh declares the verdict. It will be sin in you. That is a sharp, sharp statement. It's interesting that I didn't write the verse down, but later on, when he talks about the debtor who leaves a garment with the creditor as the security for the payment that he... Moses will say, be sure to give the cloak back to him before nightfall, because it's also his blanket, and he needs it to sleep in. And then he adds, and it will be righteousness. Here's the opposite. Yahweh declares his people righteous when they show compassion to the poor, but he declares them sinners if they reject and resist. And then we have verse 10 and 11. Notice you have verses 7 and 8, instructions on how to treat the poor. Then verse 9, warnings against mistreating the poor. And then finally, more instructions on how to treat the poor. Again, he starts with an appeal. You shall generously give to him, and your heart shall not be grieved when you give. Oh, that's not a very happy translation. Don't feel sorry for yourself. If you have to give to the poor, don't. Give generously, freely, without second thoughts. And then we appeal the warning, don't let your heart be grieved, and then the reward. For this thing the Lord has added, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in all your work. So, you understand that we always live in the light of God's grace. He has graciously redeemed us from sin. He has graciously called us to a covenant relationship. He has graciously adopted us as his children. Therefore, we live to please him. That should be motivation enough. But God, Moses keeps kicking in the notion of living in the light of future grace. I think John Piper has a book on that. Living in the light of future grace. And here he has it again. If you are gracious to the needy, God will bless you. And then you come to verse 11. For the poor, who never cease to be in the light. Moses is very realistic. He dreams of that city called Walden. We dream of it, but we're not bad. The poor will never cease to be in the land. So I command you, stay. And of course, this is the point. And it isn't law. I charge you. You shall freely open your hand to your brother, to your need, and the poor. It started out as a prayer, but it ends with just an impassionate appeal. This is the kind of people we should be. By definition, generous. And people who are by definition generous shouldn't even need the laws of verses 1, 2, and 3. We would do that naturally. But what Moses does here, he gives practical illustrations of what generosity looks like. And in that sense, the laws are a tutor. They give us the instruction on what the life of poverty is. In this community. I suppose we should close, our time is gone, as we reflect on the significance of this for us. I mean, can we say, oh, that's Old Testament? We are free from the law, happy condition. Now I can cheat and whatever with fear, without fear of provision. Of course, the sermon for us is right on the surface. This is what a transformed life looks like. Different from the world. Which is is so materialistic and hangs on to the stuff. His means of showing grace. Gracious Father, we pray that you would soften our hearts so that we become generous like you. God was so covenantally committed to the world that he opened up his hands, he gave his only son. What a generosity. What a model for us. Thanks for our begrudging forgiveness for our hard hearts. Forgive us for our twisted minds, our evil eyes, and our misshapen hands. Soften our hearts and open our hearts for the well-being of